Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Well, hello again, Liz.
Hello again.
How are you doing?
I'm just as great as I was last week.
That's great. Been up to anything new and exciting?
You know what? It's a mystery.
Seven more marks on the wall.
Time is fleeting.
Yeah.
It's astounding. Oh, shit. That was in reverse. but madness does take its toll.
That's evidence.
Yeah. So, yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, same, you know, just,
doing the time warp.
I played a lot of D&D with my family.
Oh, that's exciting.
Recording bonus material for other podcasts on other networks.
Ooh, so if you know what those are, you could check those out.
Yeah, I like that we're like, we're not going to mention them because they don't need us.
No, they don't. They're doing fine. They're doing great. yeah, but that's fun. D&D is fun. Mm-hmm. D&D with family has got to be interesting.
D&D with family is interesting. It's fun. It requires perhaps a little bit of mixology to get through.
Okay, that's fair.
You know, just
sure.
A little bit, just, you know.
Yeah, you gotta mix it up. Make some potions.
Yeah, potions that, you know, get you a little drunk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I cast Make Me a Little Drunk.
Just a little bit.
I cast Less Social Awkwardness via tequila.
Oh, yes. Yep.
I can't be a tiefling without a little...
Without a little tea?
Long Island iced tea thing.
Okay. All right. There we go. Hey-o. I knew you were going to work in a Long Island iced tea joke again.
Again? Like, that's what I fall back on.
I mean, it's always assumed now that I'm talking about Long Island iced teas. I didn't realize how defensive I'd gotten of them. I don't even drink them. But if you do,
that's
fine.
That's fine. That's the booze cast position on Long Island iced teas. It's fine.
If you do, it's fine.
If you do, it's fine. We're not gonna. We have nothing to say to you. But
yeah,
that's fine.
I've done it. We've all done it. Well,
all right.
Yeah.
So we're gonna talk about some cocktails that have arguably just as many ingredients as the Long Island iced tea, and I would say will get you just as messed up as Long Island iced tea, but
yes,
they're a little bit harder to make. But we're going to be picking up our discussion from last week on the history of tiki cocktails.
Part dos.
All right.
Yeah, so we left off in the history of this particular niche of bartending culture when tiki culture was dying out. So here enters Jeff Beachbum Berry, who is, as I mentioned last week, credited with reviving tiki bar culture. He was born in 1958, but he didn't save it then because he was a baby.
Babies can't save shit.
He hasn't even tried a Mai Tai at this point, you know? There's no way. But actually, he fell in love with tiki culture before he had ever tried a Mai Tai because he was a child when his parents took him to a Chinese restaurant in the San Fernando Valley in the LA area that featured faux Polynesian decor and elaborate cocktails with oh so many garnishes.
Yeah.
I do not know which Chinese restaurant it was, but that's where it stands.
All right.
So it's interesting because when you were talking about Don the Beachcomber last week, I thought it's interesting that he got a bunch of stuff from film sets because Jeff Berry went to UCLA for film school and worked as a journalist and screenwriter for many years and even worked for Disney as a screenwriter before he realized that he liked making drinks more than making movies.
Yeah, all right.
By the 70s, the tiki bar fad was dying out. It seemed as tacky or something your parents did. Also, another thing that we've mentioned is that a lot of the people responsible for creating these drinks didn't want their recipes getting out, didn't want their recipes getting stolen. So when those were lost, no one had any idea how to make them. And also, even when they were being created still, a lot of people had the idea that they were going to try to figure out what was in it and make maybe possibly a poor imitation of some of these drinks. So they got kind of a bad name too. So Jeff and his wife, Annan Kay, who is a former bartender, set out to rediscover the recipes and kind of reverse engineer them. So he collected old recipe books, he collected memorabilia, like placemats and coasters and all this stuff, and he sought out older bartenders to ask them to share their recipes with him. Barry and other tiki enthusiasts would gather for backyard luaus, that's in quotation, it's not really a luau, and Barry would compile some of the recipes that he researched into scrapbooks for these friends. Eventually, he published the book Beach Bum Barry's Grog Log in 1998.
It's a very good name.
Yes. And grog is rum punch, yeah? Or the predecessor of rum punch?
Grog has referred to a lot of things. It's always been rum, but like Navy Grog was the... It's a cocktail that is called Navy Grog, but before that it was just the concoction of like rum and lime juice, citrus, some sort of sweetener that they would serve watered down on Navy vessels.
So he's in like this kind of community, so to speak, of people who are really excited by the idea of tiki bar culture, even though it's not really a thing anymore. But another person who was part of the resurgence of tiki bar culture was Bosco Herniak, who is an artist that started carving tiki style sculptures and creating tiki cocktail mugs. He was soon asked to design the first tiki bar in America. That's his career. It's interesting to think about because I feel like it's not great that like a lot of bars were using original artifacts that are kind of religious and spiritual, but then this guy started like recreating in that style. And for the record, he is not of Oceanic descent. He's Serbian, which I only mentioned because he was creating art in the style of another culture.
Okay.
And he got like a lot of work from doing that and in decorating and designing tiki bars in America. So you have this resurgence of tiki culture, which is why Jeff Beach Bum Barry is regarded as a cocktail archaeologist and the Indiana Jones of tiki drinks. Because when the neo tiki bars started popping up in the 2000s, many of the recipes were ones that could be found in his books. Okay. There's like what we know as the zombie today is basically it's Jeff's recipe. We can't really say what the original was because it wasn't documented like that. They didn't want it getting out. So like the zombie, a lot of these recipes that we use today as tiki drinks are actually from Jeff Beach Bum Barry's collection and reverse engineering.
And timeline wise, because when we talk about like the rebirth of cocktail culture as a whole, that was late 90s, early 2000s. So this kind of fit in, like, why this happened was partially because you just had an interest in cocktails as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so there were all these, you know, there were all these markets opening up for people wanted pre-prohibition cocktails and people wanted, like, you know, old school cocktails. But along with that, it was just another arm of available markets, like tiki culture was lost as well.
Yes. So you're referring to like the craft cocktail movement of the late 90s. So he wrote 7 books. He opened a restaurant called Beach Bum Barry's Latitude 29 with his wife in 2014. And he's still around.
That's the one in New Orleans, right? I've been to I have to say, if there's more than one, then I don't know, but I've been to the one in New Orleans.
I only found the one. Oh. So, and he mentioned that it was the first time that he worked a full day since 1985. So
good for you.
For him. Wow. Yeah. Girl, cool. We'll
put the beach bum in that.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely regards himself as a as a beach bum. That's why. Yeah. He's, okay. Yeah. You know, he owns it.
Well, that, so he was obviously the biggest force in bringing back tiki culture in the, like you said, late 90s, early 2000s. And then that's stuck around. I mean, we still have like a swath of tiki bars
in
every city. Whenever you talk about the best bars in a given city, a couple tiki bars always pop up in the mentions. Mm-hmm. You know, they're held right up there with your pre-prohibition style bars, your speakeasy style bars. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of another style of high-end bar you can go to.
Yep. High-end bar, high-end prices, low-maintenance style in a lot of cases. You don't have to necessarily get dressed up to go to those places.
Yes, but as far as the cocktails are concerned, there is nothing low maintenance about tiki cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk a bit about the style elements of tiki.
Please, I'd love to hear it.
Because it's very distinct. It has very little overlap with a lot of the styles of cocktails we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go in drink by drink because that would be boring,
but
just give you a list of ingredients. But I want to talk about some things that pop up over and over again. So first and foremost, you want to look at like base spirits in tiki drinks. Base spirits across the board are almost always rum, and not just one kind of rum, lots of rum. As I mentioned, blending rum is something that Don was good at, and that idea has stuck with tiki cocktails throughout history.
Okay.
So, you know, when you talk about some of the classics, the Mai Tai, the Zombie, the Navy Grog, the Hurricane, the Bahama Mama, the Test Pilot, they all are based in a blend of, like, light rum, dark rum, spiced rum, Jamaican rum mixed with rum agricole. Like, there's an idea that your base spirit is starting already with a kind of complex blend.
Okay.
Now, there are some outliers to this. You know, the Fog Cutter is a classic that blends rum with gin and brandy. The Singapore Sling is, you know, famously gin-based. But across the board, more tiki cocktails are based in rum than not. Now, the other aspect, and this is one thing that made tiki kind of super inaccessible when we talk about the 70s and 80s, when you did not have fresh juices behind a bar.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't have fresh fruit. Fresh fruit juices were obviously very prominent in a lot of these drinks. You had, you know, a lot of these have pineapple juice. They've got orange juice, passion fruit juice.
Oh, yeah.
Grapefruit juice. A lot of grapefruit juice in classic tiki cocktails.
You can't get that out of a gun and it'd be okay.
No. And one thing that they do a lot, the idea of layering flavors is really important to tiki. So just as much as you're layering the rums to get, you know, like, you're using one rum to kind of calm elements of another rum or highlight elements of another rum. The same happens a lot of the times with your fruit profiles. Like, you'll label a fresh juice with a fruit liqueur.
Okay.
So, like, you'll have, like, a cherry liqueur, but then you'll also have pineapple juice. Or, you know, you'll have creme de cassis, but then you'll also have orange juice. So there's a lot of layering of, like, fruit liqueurs with fresh fruit juices.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, from what we've talked about the era of the 80s, it really is not surprising that tiki culture all but disappeared in the 80s, because that was not an era that was friendly to cocktails that needed quality ingredients to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you need, like, really, really good ingredients for this to work.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even more specific than that, you know, like, getting a hold of fresh juices, that's a bit of a headache, but another big element in tiki is the syrups that are featured over and over again also require a lot of craftsmanship. Grenadine plays a big role in a lot of these drinks. It's in one of the many iterations, but probably the most well-known iteration of the Zombie. It's in the Rum Runner. Grenadine pops up all the time, and we're talking about fresh, proper grenadine.
Yeah.
Like grenadine that's made with actual pomegranate juice, rose water, a very different thing than what you would buy in a bottle at the store. And along with that, like, you know, you've got orgeat and falernum are two big components of tiki. And those are both almond-based.
Okay.
Or, orgeat can be made with other nuts as well, but you're basically making like a nut milk.
Okay.
And you're sweetening that nut milk with some sort of sugar, and then you're infusing it. In the case of falernum, it's like spicier. It's got like, you know, like allspice or cloves or lime.
I like that word, falernum.
Falernum's a great word. Velvet falernum.
Velvet yes. falernum.
So you've got, you know, you've got these kind of milky components. Coconut milk also. Like, you know, you see coconut milk and coconut cream and some tiki drinks. All of these ingredients that are, you've got to blend your rums. You've got syrups that you have to make by hand. You've got juices that should be fresh.
Oh yeah, this is why you said that these drinks are high maintenance.
Yes. You've also got spice. Spice is a huge participant in the flavor profiles of tiki drinks, and mm-hmm. that comes via sometimes obscure liquors like pimento dram or allspice dram.
Okay.
A lot of times in these syrups, one of the sort of secret codes of Dawn that had to be cracked to understand the zombie was something called Dawn's Mix.
Yes, you've talked about this.
I love Dawn's Mix. It's one of my favorite ingredients in all of bartending, but it's a mixture of it's a cinnamon syrup that's cut with grapefruit juice.
Okay.
So, you know, but that cinnamon plays a big role in what you taste when you taste a zombie. Or grated nutmeg is another kind of spice element that comes in a lot. Like, you grate nutmeg on top of a painkiller. A relatively simple drink, but the nutmeg is really important in that.
Mm-hmm.
What other style elements we have going on? I mean, they also bring in some really classic kind of, not obscure, but not necessarily liquors that you would find in a dive bar. Like, there's a lot of finishes of Pernod or Absinthe. Find sherry showing up here and there and in some classic tiki drinks.
That's fancy.
Yeah. So when you look at it as a whole, it's a very complex bar program
mm-hmm.
to do to order.
Yeah.
And that's also sort of the ethos of tiki, is that you make these drinks to order.
Oh, yeah.
I was friends with a British bartender a while ago. I worked with one. And he was saying that, you know, for him coming up in London, in the London scene, before you ever worked at a classic cocktail style bar, you had to work in tiki. Like, you had to prove your ability to remember these complex recipes and work very fast, but very specific, because these are all small amounts. You know, you're working with six ingredient bills, where you've got a half ounce of this and a half ounce of that and a quarter ounce of this and a bar spoon of that, and you are making it to order. And so you kind of earn your stripes as a bartender by working in the world of tiki cocktails.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Absolutely.
So building out a tiki bar at your house, you know, if you're talking about your home bar, so many classic cocktails, as I've tried to emphasize over and over again, they, you know, you order them in a restaurant, they look fancy and intimidating, but you can make that at home. It's so easy to make at home.
Mm-hmm.
This family of cocktails, when we talk about it, this is the one area where I'm like, it's kind of hard to make those at home, you know?
Yeah, a little more complicated.
Yeah, there are some that are a little, you know, there are some outliers that are maybe like four-bottle pickups, but for the most part, you can't get away from any aspect of it. You need a spice, you need a fresh syrup, you need a fresh juice, you need several bottles of rum.
Yeah, wow.
And probably some obscure liquors, so.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the elements of style of tiki.
Nice.
And that I just excluded completely garnish.
The garnishes are a huge part of it.
Yeah, just, you know, palm fronds and giant pineapple wedges and the bright red cherries, like the garnish. I've seen, there's so many cool garnishes that come from these obsessive tiki style bartenders. They'll make little boats where the, like, a juiced lime half is the basin of the boat. You fill it with like overproof rum and set it on fire, so it's like a flaming boat, and you put a flag on it.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, any book, like, there are a couple cool books on garnishes out there, but most of the garnishes that you see, their origins or their use are for tiki cocktails. So
makes sense.
It is literally just specific, finicky, time-consuming bartending that results in amazing drinks.
Right. Yeah. It seems like the core elements of this, of course, yes, the ingredient elements, but the elements of this bar culture are pretty focused on these very complex, nuanced drinks that have a lot of heart and intention put behind them, and also this aesthetic. Like, I think the garnishes are kind of like both of those things, but like... Yeah.
Well, there is that kind of, you know, we talked about this sort of being... It's trying to court that aesthetic of the exotic. And I think making these builds very complicated and very sort of mysterious with, you know, 8-10 bottle pickups, it's very much courting that, like, who knows what I'm doing? It's a mystery.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Well, I mean, let's talk about exoticism.
Well, that's a huge
Let's talk about it. When we talked about doing this topic, we really wanted to give some room for the discussion of exploitation of the Polynesian and Pacific Islander and Oceanic perspective. So I kind of like grouped these in a few different ways. Number one, I think just like the obvious thing is the religious / spiritual artifact problem, because the you have like metaphorical and actual totem that's used. You can't really argue that this isn't important to the original Oceanic culture, like the right. symbol of the tiki, meaning the tiki sculpture. So Kalewa Korea, who is a curator at the Smithsonian's Asian Pacific Islander Center, puts it this way. What you're looking at, the carvings are either representations of gods or they're representations of ancestors. So if we were to put that into a context that Americans would understand, it would be like going to a Christian-themed bar with drinks served in glasses shaped like the Virgin Mary. So even though he acknowledges that Pacific Islanders, for the most part, have ignored this whole trend, he says, but seeing your ancient gods or your ancestors in a bar somewhere far from where you are, I think that can be hard.
Sure.
Which seems pretty fair.
Even to that sort of comparison, it's even more obscuring because it's like, so it's a Christian-themed bar with Jesus drinking glasses, but then there's a Star of David on the wall because we're mixing cultures that we don't understand.
Exactly, exactly. We're just grouping a lot of things together because we like the aesthetic of it. And also, I think a part of the aesthetic of it that could be particularly painful is that there's this idea of kitschiness, which, you know, like kitsch is, I like kitsch in and of itself. Like, it's this idea of like rejecting high art, and it's like, you know, like things that are aesthetic but like kind of tacky. Mm-hmm. But when you put that into the context of this is commodifying oceanic culture, like right. it's actually using someone's culture, and seeing that can be really invalidating. So Kalewa believes really at the root of it, it's exploitation. It's ignoring the real lives, the real culture, and the real problems that we do face. Yeah, and as we mentioned before, too, it's like some of these things are actual artifacts. Some of them are imitations of artifacts. So you can't really get around that. It's a little bit invalidating, I'm sure, to people who are oceanic.
It's interesting because there was not with the drinks, not with the drinking culture, but as far as the stylistic elements of tiki, there was a bit of a revival amongst like the lowbrow movement in like the 70s and 80s, like with hot rod culture and everything, like that kind of that style of that rockabilly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that emphasized a lot of the elements that we lifted from the sort of tiki culture in the 40s and 50s. But they also sometimes they commodify like even Western religious symbols. Like it's all kind of just it's all kitschy and it's all and that's not. That doesn't validate it.
Right.
But it's sort of just lumping it all in together as like lowbrow, offensive, purposely, like kind of punk rock, which mm-hmm. I don't agree with. But it is interesting that I think there's an awareness of that in our resurgence of the culture. But it's in no way more respectful.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a good point. I mean, the other thing that I wanted to talk about is just the idea, which we've kind of been talking about this throughout this topic, is the idea of escapism, which escapism in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. But when you look at it from the perspective that like the oceanic islands, particularly Hawaii, have a long history of European and American colonialism and imperialism, which gives birth to, not directly, but a lot of tiki bar culture is born out of that idea of like Americans really romanticizing and exoticism of the Polynesian culture.
Hmm.
Which trivializes the very real problems that Pacific Islanders face. I did find a really helpful article on liquor.com that interviewed two bartenders who are of Oceanic descent and who are bartenders in America. So one of them is Sam Jimenez, who is a bartender at San Francisco's Novella, who is a Mexican-American and Samoan-American heritage, who actually gave a talk called Tiki Through a Polynesian Lens at the Portland Cocktail Week, Thirst Boston, and Toronto Cocktail Conference. And he says, the white experience of escaping to the Tiki Pacific was happening at the same time that the U.S. government was testing nuclear bombs in our oceans, killing and exposing our people to toxic nuclear energy at higher levels than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, while they were using our culture to enjoy the hula dancers and the lays, our people were dying. And that's like, I mean, when you think about like, oh, well, this is all very lighthearted, like, who is this really hurting? When you have those two very seemingly separate things going on simultaneously, that's when it starts to get, you can't really get around that. There's also this whole layer of like sexualizing the indigenous people. Because part of the escapism that resulted in the American obsession with Tiki was the perceived contrast between American, like, straight-laced, button-up persona and what those Americans viewed as hedonism.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though the Oceanic people, the Polynesian people, were not overtly sexual, they were pretty conservative. They were depicted in like the kind of kitschy style of a lot of these very Western perspectives, recreations using art and like posters and all that stuff. You see Polynesian people in tiki bar art like very scantily clad. Like there's a lot of like topless women, and it's like very much like it was an image that Americans latched onto, which is problematic.
Well, and it's something that it's not like this is the only culture that we have layered on this, mm-hmm. you know, exotic hypersexual identity that doesn't exist. I mean, we've done that with cultures around the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Not just Americans. I think that's a American, yeah. European, like, yes. It's, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think that we get that, how that is painful to, you know, this discourse has been had related to a lot of cultures that we've treated similarly. I mean, we all understand that when it comes to like indigenous people of like North America, when we're talking about Native Americans, that the appropriation of the costuming of, mm-hmm. you know, the elements of their belief, like that's not right. We shouldn't do that anymore.
Right.
But Tiki is kind of this weird pocket that we just all ignore, maybe because we just like it.
Yeah, it seems like very protected, because it is, that's the thing that is the most kind of, I think, is the thing that could save or preserve this type of bar culture, because it's really, when you get down to it, it's about the drinks, it's about this kind of colorful aesthetic, which doesn't, I don't think, necessarily has to be rooted in the appropriation of Polynesian culture. Like, I think it could change, but I understand that there's a lot of people in that bar culture that would probably be very defensive of that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard when you have such a reverence for it and respect for it coming up just from like the bar knowledge angle. It's hard to say, well, we should just do away with it, because it's an entire arm of bartending.
Mm-hmm,
But regardless of that, I think it is maybe a necessity to separate the stylistic elements of the drinks, which are a class of drinks. They're brilliant, they're different, they stand on their own, they have elements that they utilize on their own, from the appropriative culture that we've kind of wrapped them in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah. Another bartender that was featured in this article on liquor.com is Ari Dukakis, who says, it's all too easy to forget that Hawaii is more than just grass skirts and poolside drinks in inappropriate mugs. Hawaii is pure. Its people are proud and resilient. Our culture is sacred, and so is our land. And while this is just a drink, I hope that it can be an open dialogue in our industry about what it means to use Polynesian culture to create a false sense of what Polynesia is. Which is bigger than, like, that is bigger than just the bar culture. Like, that's what a lot of people don't really understand, that Polynesia and all of the indigenous folks of that area have their own culture that's bigger than what we think of, like, Hawaii, luau, you know?
Sure. Well, I mean, it kind of collapses on itself because the most popular drink in Hawaii is the Mai Tai. The word Mai Tai, I believe, is Tahitian.
Mm.
Okay. For good.
Good. Great.
Just like, oh, it's a tasty drink.
Yummy.
Yeah. But that is a creation of Americans' interpretation of Polynesian culture.
Right.
That then, because that's what people expect when the tourism industry embraces that. And mm-hmm. because that's, you know, tourism is money. I understand that.
Yeah.
But then we've supplanted our culture, sort of reflected onto the Hawaiian Islands, where the drinks that were made here in America, the Mai Tai is an American invention, or is a mainland American invention, I should say. The Mai Tai isn't a thing that was invented in California before Hawaii was ever part of America, is now part of its culture, but sort of forced on it because of its association.
So, yeah, yeah.
So there is some supplanting of the culture that would have been there beforehand by what people think they're going to get when they go there.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. There's this question now of, like, you know, we're seeing, especially like in this moment in time, we're seeing a reckoning of so many things that were kind of let slide, and there hasn't really been a reckoning with tiki culture. And these, the two bartenders I mentioned, actually made some suggestions for how to, like, keep the drink culture and take steps away from the appropriation aspect of it, or the exploitation of it all. And one of those suggestions is, maybe we change the name. Maybe it's tropical drinks, which I'm sure is going to be met with a lot of resistance. But there's this whole thing with the reclaiming of Hawaiian words, Polynesian words like tiki, and like even like the aloha spirit being part of hospitality, where very much like the indigenous people of North America, they had their language stripped from them. They weren't allowed to speak their language. So then seeing their language used in this way, in like a commodifying way, can be painful.
Hmm.
Maybe not tiki. Maybe we change the word. Maybe.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's... I have no personal, like, that's the thing. Like, I have no personal attachment to tiki, but I do understand that to some people, it's not necessarily right, but it's a lot of, it's entire bars' identities.
Yes.
It's bartenders' identities. That's how they've established themselves in the industry. That is what they've dedicated their styles and their research and their establishments to.
Named books.
But that's exactly, like, I have friends that have published books proudly that are tiki books. And that is what they are proud of they are also archaeologists of the style and the understandings. Mm-hmm. And that is, I don't think it's as easy as, first off, I will say, I think that the right choice is to move beyond appropriating other cultures' iconography and their language. Mm-hmm. I absolutely think that is the right choice. I understand the connection that a lot of people have, a lot of modern day bartenders have to this class of drinks. But I do think that, you know, I think an evolution we have to choose to make as bartenders to separate the really, like, damn good drinks that came from this and just categorize them differently. Because at the end of the day, if our goal is to create an escapist environment, you're absolutely right. We can do that without I think that you can have just as much fun with a beach theme bar having big goofy boat drinks. I mean, I think if you take the appropriation out of tiki culture, we're talking about Margaritaville,
which is fine. We can,
that's just where we land, but you know, that's fine.
Right. Well, that's like, I mean, that's another example of, like, I mean, I love kitsch. Like, you can be kitschy and do it in a way that's not exploiting another person's culture. Like, I mean, you know, another one of their suggestions is, like, maybe reconsider the tiki mugs. Maybe don't drink out of those. Maybe, like, the cloth that is usually known to be like a ceremonial pattern, like, maybe don't use that.
Put them on your napkins. Yeah,
you know, exactly. Well,
that's interesting. I wonder, what do you think, and this is just, I'm just spitballing here, I don't have a good answer, but, like, the novelty tiki mugs that are, like, Darth Vader and Yoda.
Yeah.
How does that fall into things? It's appropriating the style of those, but it's using different iconography.
I don't know. I also don't know the answer to that.
I guess because we're not like, the people to have an answer.
Right, but. No, we're not. I mean, is it far enough removed? But yeah, like you said, we're definitely not the people to ask that. It also is just like, it's very, we've kind of done ourselves a bad thing by naming it that in the first place. Like, you know, now it's kind of gotten so far that I don't know if, you know, we can definitely push for it to be called something different, but it's like, it's inherently a style now. Like, is it too late? But could we take steps to maybe even like the first step is actually just like educating ourselves on the history of those of that region, because I don't think a lot of people in the West or in America like really consider the amount of imperialism that Hawaii and other Polynesian and Oceanic cultures have faced.
Right.
You know, we don't really consider that because we're so wrapped up in the whole escapism of it.
Right. Well, that's good to know, because that's the redux of it. It's not just American tiki style bartending appropriated imagery that they didn't quite understand. It's that the whole reason that we encountered that culture was because of colonialism and imperialism that caused a lot of harm. So it's not just, whoops, we got the symbolism wrong, you know, and it's not the same as saying like, oh, well, you know, if an American opens up a sushi restaurant, I mean, there is an homage or is it appropriation? That's one level of it. But there's no point in time where you go back and you find the roots of this style of bartending in any of these places that we're attributing it to.
Right. And that was lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, none of these drinks like were taken from Hawaiian culture and just remade here. It was an entirely American invention using entirely American ingredients, really. Like there was obviously, I mean, the exoticism of like, oh, fresh juices and like exotic spirits, that was all created by these early pioneers of the style. It wasn't something that they picked up. Things like orgeat and falernum and spice syrups, those were around in you know, in Caribbean cocktail culture, in anything that went along with rum. People were making grogs and mixtures with rums all the way back to the original punch made in India.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, just like considering that even puts that into perspective. When we talk about like things that we associate with like Caribbean cocktail culture, like, that's an entirely different region. There's a whole continent in between.
Exactly. Those places. And there are notes. So you could trace back a lot of these ingredients there.
Right.
Because that's when we start mixing with rum. You're talking about like this is back in like the British naval days where they were taking a lot of stuff from the cultures they were encountering there. And that's a basis for a lot of punch. And like, you know, a lot of those ideas come from there. But you're absolutely right. They are not at all related, just because they are island cultures close to the equator.
Yeah,
like they're not they're same,
completely different places.
Yeah. And that's really, because that's even extends it, like, so we're mixing together not just, you know, we're homogenizing the cultures of Hawaii and of Samoa and of Easter Island, and like we're just saying, oh, they're all the same, but we're also throwing in some stylistic notes that we get from the Caribbean, and then Chinese, like, food, because why not?
Oh, well, like, it's an island. It's fine. Put all the island stuff together.
It is very, there's no, you can't trace it back. It's like somebody from Hawaii opening an authentic tiki bar couldn't really happen. There is no authentic tiki bar.
Right. It's just not authentic.
It's a fictional creation.
Yes.
So I guess it's hard to say, like, could you do it right? I don't know.
Yeah. Because that's a good question.
That's the thing. Like, I understand somebody that has a vested interest in their tiki bar that they've run for 20 years, and it's iconic to their neighborhood. We have a ton in New York.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I have friends that run tiki bars, but we are doing a lot of, like you said, we're doing a lot of reevaluating in our culture right now. We're trying to hold ourselves accountable, and I don't think that this should miss the discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and it's not like we have to rename all the cocktails or get rid of them all. They're
Cocktails are fine. They're
the drinks are great.
They have nothing to do with Polynesian culture, so they're fine.
Yeah, and like, I mean, some of the names pull from different cultures.
True. That's true.
But at the same time, a lot of cocktails have names that come from other cultures. That's just just how we name things.
True.
I mean, a Paloma, I don't think is dismissive of Spanish.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because it's a drink. It's just a drink. I mean, that's, yeah, it's where is the line of like, okay, these things are harmless because these are just drinks. And then like, we expand so much on that as far as aesthetic. And then it gets into this really can be very painful area from there.
If it's something that you truly love, if tiki style bartending, I think removing the parts of it that could be painful to others just improves it.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't you want everybody to feel safe and good about being in that environment? Yeah. I feel like that's what the intention from it is like, we put in so much thought and effort into curating these beautiful cocktails. Like, you don't want your cocktails to hurt anybody.
No, and you know, I know, like, it sounds so, what do you mean you want to get rid of our tiki mugs? It's like, well, I mean, as drink vessels, you know, there's nothing special about them that improves the cocktails. I mean, a lot of the time when we talk about glassware, we're talking about things that are shaped certain ways to increase the way we encounter, like, the nose of a drink, or keep it cold longer, or allow it to breathe better. The tiki mug is literally just appropriation. It's just a cool-looking thing that is removed from the culture that we took it from. So,
right.
I don't.
Well, that's a good point, because it's also there are some tiki style bars that are instead like choosing glassware that's like, it looks like a dolphin, or it looks like a flamingo, which is something that the two bartenders I mentioned, Discauskas and Jimenez, mentioned that, you know, if you're going to get those mugs that are like, they're not tiki mugs, they're like different shapes,
sharks.
They're flamingos, sharks, whatever, like maybe look into the company that you're getting it from and see if they also make tiki mugs, and then maybe reconsider, you know, you'd use a different company, like, or you know, address that. Like, we are in a great place to move forward right now, because I think a lot of us are willing to look at how we source things and like, where we are spending our money, or where, like, the kind of patronage we're giving to certain companies. Like, we want to take a look at that everywhere. So, you know, that's it. It can't hurt to look at that kind of stuff. It can only possibly help someone feel less harmed, you know?
In agreeing to do this episode, I had to investigate my internal reaction to the thought of throwing away a lot of these stylistic and terms that we use for tiki bartending, because to me, just coming up as a bartender, it was a pinnacle of what I do.
Absolutely.
Like, that thought to me was like, no, that's like, but it, how is it still harmful? Now it is just a fun style of bartending. And I mean, I read some articles where other bartenders kind of had that similar, like, you know, immediate reaction of, but this is, now it's somebody else's, now it's my culture. Like, this is part of my culture now, is tiki bartending. It doesn't really originate anywhere, so it's just a made-up thing, but now it's important to me.
Yeah.
But I think anytime you have those moments of, like, absolutely not, like, you have to kind of dig deeper and go, but what really of this matters? How much of this is really my identity? And it's, you know, I think that you cut away it. It's like, well, it's a very caring, loving, layered style of drink making, and that never has to change.
Yeah,
we can cut away the parts of it that hurt people and still get left with this really, I mean, that's what I love about it. I don't the iconography doesn't mean anything to me, because it's literally not mine.
Right,
it's not mine to find meaning in. The love and care and artistry and I don't know, absurd specificity that goes into these drinks.
Yes.
That's what I love about them.
Yeah.
And that will never go away. So if anybody's listening out there and you're just like, absolutely not, I love those kind of bars, that is my thing, or I own one or whatever, I understand the defensive reaction, because it was my original reaction. Mm-hmm. But I think if you look at it and really think about, like, what do you really love about it? The kitsch falls away. You know, the goofy wrappings of it fall away.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I think we can move forward. I'm interested to see how this goes.
Boat drinks, tropical drinks. Yeah, hey, it's fine.
We rename stuff all the time. It's fine. Thanks for that. We're not going to do a live stream this week. We are going to put up a special video of some sort that will be announced later.
It's been a while. We love the live streams, but they're very long and maybe not like the most digestible if you just want to like have some cool cocktail recipes. So we're going to provide a little bit of that content this week.
Yeah.
Switch it up a bit.
Do a little shorty for you and give a little instructional video that's
I don't know where you're listening from, but here in New York we're in the middle of a heat wave, so we just want to give you some tools to combat that.
Yes, some good ideas for how to stay cool and enjoy some cool cocktails. Yeah, so stay tuned for that. Thank you to Absurdist for our theme music. Thank you to all of our Patreons. Thanks to anyone who is retweeting us on Twitter. You can follow us at Neat Boozcast on Twitter and Instagram. We do post updates to those, so if we're doing any kind of live stream or post a new episode, that's going to be up there first, which I guess if you're listening to this, you've already seen it. But hey, what's up? Hey, guys. But yeah, again, thank you so much. And if you are one of our Patreon members, look out because we just sent out some goodies. So those will be coming your way soon.
Yes.
We've got stickers and coasters.
We are getting caught up on those. And also, probably by the time you hear those will be in the mail. But then your next package will be soon behind.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get right on August after this.
Yeah. And also, so if you were previously signed up as $5 or more, then you got the stickers and coasters up till now. But in the future, just to cover the costs of getting those made and shipping those out, the Coaster Club, which includes the coasters and the stickers monthly, you'll need to sign up for the $8 level. And if you had been under $4, then you're going to need to sign up for the $4 if you want the stickers moving forward. We will be posting other content on Patreon, so if you don't sign up for one of those tiers, don't worry, you'll still get something, but it will be virtual because we do need to cover shipping costs. As it turns out, it costs money to ship things.
Yes.
So we figure that out now.
Yes. And if you even if you don't join us for the Patreon, we will in the coming weeks have ways that if you're interested in just buying the art, I will say a la carte.
A la carte art.
Yes. Obviously, you get a better discount with the Patreon, but mm-hmm. we will be offering that soon too.
Yeah, so, we'll be making those available in a little shop somewhere. Stay tuned.
All right. Well, I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been Neat.